what Hegel says in the crucial passage here is the true and the good, wisdom and virtue, are general terms beyond which Stoicism cannot get, are therefore in a general way no doubt uplifting, but since they cannot in fact produce any expansion of content, they soon become tedious. So there is a presumption in Stoicism that the freedom of thought will have a content. So this question about why tedium sets in and why it should be unsatisfying, is because it expects to get something from that independence of thought. That is, a content. But because its content is, in fact, thoughts without content, it simply gets itself. So it wants content, and it gets itself. That's the problem. So it cannot get what it wants because it doesn't get either the true, it doesn't get wisdom or virtue. Not as contentful things. Okay. Now, the crux here is Stoicism is oddly problematic because it is supposed to be a version of a dual consciousness. But the way in which it operates as a dual consciousness is to repudiate its duality. That is, it sets up a dualism between self and world and reconciles them, so-called, by denying the world as anything it might be dependent on. Hence, it is left with an emptiness and therefore a repetition. Skepticism is to Stoicism what the master is to the slave. So the idea of Stoicism, so Stoicism and skepticism are, as it were, within this now structure of thinking about self-consciousness as belonging to each individual, right? Stoicism and skepticism themselves rehearsal of the moments of mastery and slavery. So the emptiness of Stoicism is like the emptiness of the master. Something that goes nowhere, right, is essentially static. Skepticism, therefore, is meant to be the actuality of what Stoicism is in idea only.
The Stoic's not vicious. I mean, the master, the master is, you know, thinking as you mentioned earlier that what the banal recognitive cognitive theories of master can't get out of the master viciousness.
Right.
And
Stoicism is not vicious.
It's not vicious. And I wonder if under this reason, which is why it's so tedious maybe, that viciousness is in some ways as an expansion of content, that particular way of overcoming the tedium of mastery. Horrible as that might sound.
It is, except it's so, it is also tedious. Which is why, torture is the model, right?
It might
so, 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 so.
be vicious, in other words.
Sure, but the viciousness can only take the form, right, of the nothingness of the other. And as we know, torturers simply get bored torturing their victims, and then they kill them. And there's no satisfaction, right? So torture, right, part of the problem of torture is that the torturer never gets the satisfaction he expects out of the experience. He has this complete sovereignty. Well, why is that? Well, I want to say, ultimately, it's because it's about sovereignty, and therefore it has an essential emptiness to it. There is no content other than the dualism. I am not the other, I am independent.
That's Stoicism. And the master has this supplement, which is viciousness.
Yeah. But I'm saying the viciousness dies down. And then comes back, of course.
Right.
Torture
again.
Still
like a sovereign. So if it's about sovereignty, it struck me as interesting. So that Stoicism and its relationship to the world is also sovereign, as is the master's to the slave. Mm-hmm. In other words, if it's all about sovereignty, then sovereignty can't give the account of viciousness, because you don't have viciousness with the Stoic. Was also sovereign. That's my question. So viciousness must be about more than sovereignty. And I'm wondering if it might be about, in some way, response to, or the symptom of, if you like, the demand of tedium, the determinacy of tedium.
Some way of giving content to the emptiness.
Not entirely satisfying what I agree, but it's got to be about more than sovereignty.
Well, it's
otherwise it's just Stoicism.
Right, you know, and it's certainly not that. It is, I guess I want to say it's a certain kind of relationship between Stoicism and skepticism. It's the active negation of the other as other. Yeah, there has to be an extra. So the skepticism So what was wrong with Stoicism, Hegel says, is that it left the nothingness of the world implicit rather than making it explicit. In skepticism, he says in paragraph 202, the wholly unessential and non-independent character of this other becomes explicit for consciousness. The abstract thought becomes concrete thinking, which annihilates the being of the world in all its manifold determinateness. And the negativity of free self-consciousness comes to know itself in the many and varied forms of life as a real negativity. So Stoicism is the idea of the freedom of consciousness, and skepticism is the work, literally the work of the freedom of self-consciousness. Which is, again, what Hegel says in the very next paragraph. It is clear that just as Stoicism corresponds to the notion of the independent consciousness which appeared as the Lord and bondsman relationship, so skepticism corresponds to its realization as a negative attitude toward otherness, to desire and work. But although desire and work were unable to effect the negation for self-consciousness, this polemical bearing towards the manifold independence of things will, on the other hand, be successful, because it turns against them as a free self-consciousness, that is already complete in its own self, more specifically because it is thinking. So this is still about the freedom of thought. Still about the freedom of thought. But now it's going to demonstrate the freedom of thought by showing that each determinate thing is determinate in the light of thought, and in the light of thought only, that is, has no independent determinacy, and hence it will show for each determinate thing that it can be negated, because there can be an equal and opposing thought, which is just as valid, and therefore the determinateness of the thing counts as nothing. So, what skepticism tries to demonstrate is that every epistemic and evaluative distinction is relative to cognition, and in showing that it's relative to cognition, it's showing that there is no independent value of any idea, which is to say, always in skepticism, skepticism always begins with the nominalist critique of the universal. Always begins with the nominalist critique of the universal, which is to say that the universal is not an independently existing thing, but could be, it's just the name for a determination of thought. And hence there is no ultimate truth or worth, no true or good. But to show that is to show the nothingness of the world. Now, again, ancient skepticism meant to show that nothing could push me one way or the other. That is, no set of experiences could be determined my thinking. Therefore, there was no right thing to do. Hence, the goal of ancient skepticism was ataraxia, or an attitude of indifference. Now, skepticism can only therefore reassure itself, and that's what it wants to do. It wants to reassure itself about its ultimate authority in relationship to the world through contesting the authority of any given object. That is, it must contest the givenness of the world itself. But this requires a continual return to the very object I mean to count as nothing. So skepticism begins to look very familiar to us. That is, it looks very much like self-certainty. And as you remember, a self-certain consciousness would assure itself of the nothingness of the object by consuming it, but that turned out to be unsatisfying because the desire came back and it was dependent on that object for having something to consume. Well, the same with skepticism. skepticism cannot deny the givenness of the world except by having the world be given and denying that givenness. Hence, skepticism is really a certain type of movement, a continual movement between the object and the negation of the object and the negation of the negation of the object and the return of the object. But yet skepticism can only work, can only be a form of consciousness, if these two moments are held apart and yet related to one another. So the skeptic has to separate himself into two selves in order to make the skeptical power of negative freedom his essence. So what Hegel is going to be offering us here in the middle of this account is a phenomenological deduction of the coming into existence of the relationship between transcendental and empirical consciousness. That transcendental and empirical consciousness are not merely terms of art, not merely Kant's Copernican term, but rather Hegel wants to demonstrate the coming to be of this divided consciousness as itself a structured coming to be, and he further wants to be arguing right here and now that Kant's notion of transcendental empirical consciousness is essentially skeptical. It is the structure of skepticism itself. So if he can get his argument right here, we will have, as it were, identified Kantian self-consciousness with skepticism itself. So the hunch, right, that people like Jacobi had, that Kantian theory was a form of transcendental skepticism, I know appearances only in things themselves, turns out to be literally the case, that it is actually built on or out of skepticism. It is skepticism formed is as a formation of the structure of self-consciousness itself. So in a sense, it's deep. I'll come back to this deduction in a moment. It's deep because skepticism is the first explicit acknowledgement of the divided character of the self. It's the explicit awareness of myself as a divided consciousness, of having, if you want to say it, a master and a slave moment within me, having a moment within me of, essentially, independence and dependence. So this little account of skepticism is meant to be doing an awful lot of work for Hegel. Okay. Well, we know that, so let's look about how all this comes about. And I read paragraph 205 as this phenomenological deduction of transcendental and empirical. Although I'm suggesting to you that we should have seen this coming a mile away when we had master-slave as the fundamental structure of self-consciousness.
and they get layered in. Now, this was always what Hegel was going to be up to, right? Of trying to understand us as essentially divided consciousness. And then the question of the book will be, how do we get these two sides, these divided bits, together? How can we reconcile them? So in paragraph 205, Hegel says, on the contrary, consciousness itself is the absolute dialectical unrest. So it's a movement. It's going to be a movement between transcendental and empirical. That's my claim here. Between the essential and the unessential, between the changeable and the unchangeable. Looking forward. This medley of sensuous and intellectual representations, whose differences coincide. So again, that's another way of thinking about the difference. It's between particular and universal, sensuous and intellectual. Plato's divided line, not now as the ontological structure of the universe, but as the structure of self-consciousness itself. Who we are. And we're now set up for that, having heard the story about solecism. We're willing to begin to understand that duality within our own self-consciousness. This medley of sensuous and intellectual representations, whose differences coincide and whose identity is equally again dissolved, for it is itself determinateness as contrasted with the non-identical. That is, I make myself determinate through the negation of the other. So my determinacy is dependent on the power of my negation. So I both am determined by that other, and I'm free of it because it's that which I negate. But it is just this process. I want to get that door. That this consciousness, instead of being self-identical, is in fact nothing but a purely causal, confused medley, the dizziness of a perpetual self-engendered disorder. So the problem here is that the moments of transcendental and empirical are not sorted out structurally, but continually come up as independent moments that have no order. And that's important because the unhappy consciousness is going to allow some structure and order in the notion of divided consciousness. It is self-aware of this, for it itself maintains and creates this restless confusion. This is the meaning of the skeptic as, and this is going to keep this in mind for when Hegel talks about Diderot, about Rameau's nephew, who's going to be a version of this creation of confusion and disorder in the midst of Enlightenment rationalism. Hence, it also admits to it its own to being a wholly contingent, single, and separate consciousness, so it has to admit. Right? And this is why this is crucial. This is the advance beyond Stoicism. I have to admit I am a wholly contingent, single, separate consciousness, a consciousness which is empirical. We didn't know that's what he was heading toward. Which takes its guidance from that, from what has no reality for it. Just as in the ideal, the Copernican turn, things have no independent reality for transcendental consciousness because they receive their determinacy from conceptual thought. That's the claim of the Copernican turn. that they are both empirical, given, and yet not determinate on their own. That's Kant's claim, that they gain their determinacy through conceptual determination. So, which takes its guidance from what has no reality for it. Notice, it takes its guidance from. Remember in the very first class, I'm sure you don't, that's why I'm saying remember, I said the problem with the relationship of concept to intuition in Kant was this, that the object gets its determinacy from the concept. Right? That we only have a green object when I give it the concept green. And my question was, how do I know which concept to apply? I have to be guided by the very thing I claim I determine. Unless the thing indicates to me it's green, give it green concept, hey, I'm green. There has to be some way in which intuitions are not blind. Otherwise, if they were completely blind, we wouldn't know which concepts to use. We could use any concepts. Which, of course, is the terror underlying Kant's project, right? Which is what the third critique is about. Trying to assuage that terror that we're not just making it up, we're not just imposing our conceptual scheme. Right? Which is the problem with all forms of Copernicanism, idealism. It's idealism for a reason, namely, how do we know we're just not making all this up, just cooking it up so we can say anything we want about the object? And yet, so it takes its guidance from what has no reality for it, which obeys what is for it not an essential being, which does those things and brings to realization what it knows has no truth for it. But equally, while it takes itself in this way to be a single, separate, contingent, and in fact animal life, and a lost self-consciousness, it must take itself to be that, or it wouldn't have to be skeptical about it. There's nothing to be skeptical about unless I am already lost and trying to get out of that lostness. So it also, on the contrary, converts itself again into a consciousness that is universal and self-identical, A equals A, I think, the transcendental unity about perception. So that, and then he says, together. From this self-identity, or within its own self, it falls back again into the former contingency and confusion, for the same spontaneous negativity, as if we hadn't seen the Fichte and the Kant all over this notion of essential consciousness. He makes it clear, this is the spontaneity of thought, it's the capacity for negation, it's its full independence from the object. From this self-identity, or within its own self, it falls back again into the former contingency and confusion, for the same spontaneous negativity has to do solely with what is single and separate and occupies itself with what is contingent. So indeed, Adam, you were right to think, right, that he's trying to think concepts without intuitions are empty, intuitions without concepts are blind, but it cannot hold on to that thought. This is Kant's theory right here. This is the thoughts that concepts
without intuitions are empty, and intuitions without concepts are mine. He has just said that. That's what we've been reading for the last 6-7 sentences. And that is skepticism, because that is not a reconciliation of the two moments, but exactly a continual moment of non-reconciliation. Hence, as if he hadn't given Kant a hard enough time already, just to dig it in, he says, this consciousness is therefore the unconscious. Thoughtless rambling which passes back and forth from one extreme of self-identical self-consciousness to the other extreme of the contingent consciousness that is both bewildered and bewildering. It does not bring these two thoughts of itself together. That is, the idea of transcendental and empirical as thought within the Kantian dictum of conceptual intuitions are empty, intuitions of concept are blind, is a failure to think how they're related. It's not the relating, it's the failure to think that, is Hegel's claim. And of course, not only is it a failure to think that relation, and that's a theoretical point, it's also self-defeating, which is going to be, let's call it, the phenomenological touchstone. It affirms the nullity of seeing, hearing, etc. It is itself seeing, hearing, etc. It affirms the nullity of ethical principles and lets its conduct be governed by these very principles. I take it, the thought is something like Descartes. What does Descartes say about what we ought to do? We ought to do whatever the conventions of our locale tell us to do. Because it doesn't matter. Since it's all just convention anyway, right? And we have to act, we have to carry on, so we both say they're nothing, which is what Descartes says. There's no ultimate authority, they're just conventions. Every state is different. Ergo, you might as well follow the conventions of the place you're in. So they have absolute authority. So they're both nothing and everything. Its deeds and its words always belie one another, and equally it has itself the doubly contradictory consciousness of unchangeableness and sameness, and of utter contingency and non-identity with itself. That's why they're not brought together. It's because what we have here is two extremes: absolute self-identity and utter contingency, and there is simply nothing that could, as it were, bring them together. Hegel imagines this coming undone, curiously, only when one skeptic meets another skeptic. Because one skeptic meets another skeptic, it's not exactly clear, right, how the negation is going to work, since the negation has already negated your negation of its, so you just get
so that it can't carry out its practice. It has to acknowledge the other. So it's another skeptic that again represents a moment of non-negatable determinacy. So the claim here, if this is right, is that the distinction between transcendental and empirical consciousness. I mean, let me say two things here. First of all, one of the things that Hegel is saying here that's so important is that skepticism is conditioned. It doesn't come from nowhere. It's not a direct given of thought. It's a conditioned moment in the history of self-consciousness. It is one of the ways in which consciousness attempts to make sense of itself in terms of the world it inhabits. So skepticism is not a primitive idea, but a conditioned idea. And hence, we're already beyond skepticism, right? To show the genealogy of skepticism is to already have gone beyond skepticism. It's also a trying, ironically, to say that Kant is deeper and yet worse off than he knew. Kant is deeper than he knew because the phenomenological genesis of the divided consciousness shows that it gets at a non-refractable experience of human self-understanding. That it's not just a philosophical theory, we might say. That what he's trying to give to Kantian self-understanding, we may say, is an existential pathos. Or we might even say an historical existential pathos. And that's the sense in which there is a depth to Kant, a kind of melancholic depth that Kant himself was only half aware of. Half aware of, I think. Conversely, of course, he is suggesting again that if he's right, Kantianism is itself necessarily intrinsically skeptical. It is a formulation of the skeptical relationship to the world, of the problem, namely of the divided character of consciousness, our experience of ourselves as self-conscious beings being divided. So stoicism and skepticism, we ought to be clear about this, I've said, are attitudes of self-consciousness about its relationship to the world. But of course, they're not therefore just attitudes. We say they're philosophical attitudes that attempt to make sense of our relationship to ourselves and the world in general. And it's because they're philosophical attitudes that attempt to make sense our relationship to the world in general, that they can only arise at a particular time and place, that is, become explicit at a certain moment. Even if, again, in a certain way, they're kind of always and everywhere. questions about skepticism before I... It's all clear.
This is good.
He's actually saying what some people have said, namely that Kant is a sophisticated Hume. So people complain about my old dissertation director's Kant, W. H. Walsh's book on Kant, that it's too Humean. And I think Walsh thought it was a matter of emphasis between Kant and Hume, not an absolute difference. So, of course, Hume is a moment in Kant, which is, so that passage I read, the confused medley, the dizziness of perpetually self-engendered disorder, can be, you know, a moment of Hume talking about the, you know, the flow of impressions and ideas, and just kind of come and go and flow and all that. Yeah?
When you read Sextus Empiricus, what he's arguing for is that we have to overcome our desire to believe.
Right.
That we have an inclination.
Absolutely.
And so there's a kind of control of desire or that kind of rule that's happening there.
Right.
Is that, can that be understood in terms of what Tegel's doing here, or is that sort of like a...
No. It's perfect. I mean, remember, he already did that in a way with skepticism. He said stoicism. He said stoicism must, as it were, give up on desire if it's going to succeed as thought alone. So, again, skepticism would be simply making explicit that the desire needs to be overcome. Above all, the desire to believe, if you're really going to achieve independence from the world. So you know it's necessary. Yeah?
Can you clarify just for a minute?
Stoicism simply repudiates the connectedness between these two moments. So it says, and actually it's very explicit about it, it says, there is nature which has its own movement and laws. Nature actually within Stoicism is a, you know, and thought is on the other side. And it can... So in order to claim that it is just thought, it has to claim its utter indifference beyond this of this. So it is a divided consciousness that repudiates its dividedness, is Stoicism. Stoicism is a divided consciousness that fails to recognize itself as divided. Skepticism recognizes that it is both moments. That is, you can't just say, oh, and there's nature out there. Nothing to do with me, mate. Right? So skepticism does this and then does it as a certain movement of continual overcoming, of its determinacy, its bodily being, etc., by showing their non-being. So it's an attempt to bring the two into relation by showing my independence from what is nonetheless part of me. And, you know, this stoical, skeptical attitude is absolutely everywhere in our speech, in our thinking about the world. I'm sorry I said what I said to you. I was tired. My body said it. I didn't say it. I'm sorry I did that. I was drunk. I'm sorry, you know, I was in a bad... You know, we can just hear the ways in which we automatically... Let's be absolutely clear. My claim is this notion of our divided consciousness is not about philosophical theories. These are absolutely the deepest strands of our everyday self-understanding. It's not as if we're beyond these movements. It's simply how deep or how structured our thinking about these movements are. Right? And I want to say that for the most part, we actually drift more towards Stoicism than any other of the forms of thought. So I think there's a necessity. Absolutely, skepticism is the successor form to Stoicism. So what we are seeing in Stoicism, skepticism, and then in the unhappy consciousness is a bringing of the master-slave relationship into each self. Structured moments of our self-relation and self-understanding. So, and I think what I'll do here is just say a word about the transition and then stop. I want to try to get into the details of unhappy consciousness tonight. Given it's already 10:20. So paragraph 206. In skepticism, Hegel says, consciousness truly experiences itself as internally contradictory. From this experience emerges a new form of consciousness which brings together the two thoughts which skepticism holds apart. So now I'm saying skepticism acknowledges that the two moments belong to it, but tries to hold them apart and tries to keep them, as it were, so, and because it keeps them apart, all it can do is bounce from one to the other. right? So it doesn't bring them together, it simply goes back and forth. I'm conditioned, I'm unconditioned. And of course the answer is both are true. Both are true, and they have to be brought together. And hence the new form of consciousness is one which brings together the two thoughts which skepticism holds apart. Skepticism's lack of thought about itself must vanish because it is in fact one consciousness which contains within itself these two modes. So what we've been looking at in Stoicism and Skepticism, now the other consciousness, is again the story, we're back to the idea of one consciousness facing the world, trying to make sense of itself, only now the one consciousness is truly self-conscious, where what is to be self-conscious but to be involved in this structure of a divided consciousness. And we know that that structure of divided consciousness is in part derivative from, although unacknowledged here, its origin in sociality, which is here completely disappeared. Completely disappeared. This new form is therefore one which knows that it is the dual consciousness of itself, as self-liberating, unchangeable, and self-identical, and as self-bewildering and self-perverting, and it is the awareness of this self-contradictory nature itself. That is the genius of religion, the genius of Christianity, is that it knows its relationship is contradictory. It knows it has two fundamental thoughts about itself, and they're in direct contradiction with one another. I am a living, single, empirical, contingent, mortal being. No, I'm not. I am a soul, unchanging, self-identical, universal, etc., etc. So Christianity acknowledges the contradiction, and its genius is to say, unlike Stoicism and Skepticism, it starts from the perspective of empirical consciousness, of dependent consciousness, of being contingent, of having, why not use the word, of having always already fallen into the world, out of Eden, and now it has to figure out as a fallen, broken, empirical, damaged, pain, etc., consciousness, that it knows that this experience of itself, its mortal coil, is not the truth about itself. That it knows that somehow the truth about itself is more than this fleshy self, and it has to, and it thinks of that more as its relationship to God. That God represents my true essence. He's my creator. Therefore, I partake somehow of that essence, of the unchangeable. And the trick now is, how do I bring myself in relationship to it? Christianity is nothing but a set of practices which aim at a self-overcoming of my empirical being in order that I can join up with my true self in the beyond. So I am essentially unhappy because I am separated from my true essence. That's what the fall is. And therefore, I have to manage a set of practices that can bring me back into alignment with what is already the truth about me. Exactly what those practices are, you can look at next week.
So it looks a lot like Stoicism. The difference is just the starting point.
Absolutely.
It's just that it starts falling.
And you're going to see, of course, that the moments are going to look terribly familiar, right? So that the moments within Christianity, they're going to be stoical and skeptical and related moments within Christianity, because their starting point is not with thought, but ironically with body. With body as that aspect. Hence, not an accident, right? That Christ on the cross is what distinguishes Christianity from every other religion. Suffering Christ. The mortal Christ. So we're going to have to talk about the Trinity and all that kind of stuff, but we'll do that.